supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. A new study out of Stanford University finds a strong relationship between difficult childhood experiences and behavioral, even physical, health problems in children. The study also found that children might be misdiagnosed with ADHD and other disorders when what they're really suffering from is this kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is part of a growing body of research on the impact of childhood trauma and adverse experiences on physical and mental health. On today's show, we'll discuss what we know about this relationship, what we are learning, and maybe most important, what we are doing with this knowledge. In a minute, we'll hear from Drs. Sandy Bloom and Steve Perkowitz, both well-known experts in the field of trauma, adverse childhood experiences, and health. But first, let's take a look at what is the biggest study in this general field, the ACE, or Adverse Childhood Experience Study. It's a collaboration between the CDC and Kaiser Permanente, and joining us to talk about the study is Mike and Scott. She is WHYY's behavioral health reporter. So, Mike, and tell us how this study came about.
I was able to speak with Dr. Vincent Felitti last week, who was one of the primary investigators on this study. And what he was telling me was that years ago, he was working in San Diego with a population of morbidly obese people. And they were doing this trial where people were given basically no food and to lose large amounts of weight. They were getting injections and so on. And what he found was that the people who were most successful with the trial, the weight loss, were those who would drop out and disappear. So once they were successful in losing weight, they didn't want to do it. And that was pretty much limited to the successful group. The people who were lying and cheating and eating on the side, they stayed with the study. So he figured there had to be something going on that he did not understand. And then he realized, digging deeper, that there was a lot of people had a history of sexual abuse, child sexual abuse. So the obesity on some level was a strange coping mechanism that they were doing to, in a way, desexualize themselves and also to cope with strong emotions. The eating was a way to do that.
So that was sexual abuse.
Yes.
But what did they actually look at?
Right. So then he figured there has to be a stronger relationship between this child traumatic experiences in childhood and later problems in life. So they set up this study, and over 17,000 people participated and filled out a detailed survey about what they called adverse experiences in childhood. Now, to give you an example, those were recurrent physical abuse, recurrent emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and incarcerated household members. Somebody who is chronically depressed or suicidal in the household. Those were those experiences, and they didn't score, you know, incidents of those experiences, but just asked, was that present? So they didn't ask how many times did it happen, but just scored them based on whether those things were present. And then they saw what other problems those people developed later in life. So why don't we take a listen to the interview I taped with Dr. Felitti, and I asked him, you know, what were some of the things they found that were correlating with those adverse childhood experiences?
The results were profound in terms of emotional state, depression, attempted suicide, in terms of so-called health risks, alcoholism, promiscuity, street drug use, in terms of biomedical disease, long bone fractures, liver disease, heart disease, pulmonary disease, malignancy. So it played out in a number of broadly different realms, and overwhelmingly not recognized in terms of the original underpinnings of all of this. And one of the most important conclusions that we slowly came to was the realization that many of the things that are considered public health problems are indeed that, but in addition, tend often to be unconsciously attempted solutions to problems that no one knows exists. For instance, nicotine. The risk is real. The risk is in 15 or 20 years. The benefit is equally real in 15 or 20 seconds. The benefit being that nicotine has been well recognized as having potent anti-anxiety activity, as having potent antidepressant activity, and as having potent anger suppressant activity.
As you were going through these results, what was the most surprising to you?
I think the prevalence of them and the intensity of their effect so many decades later. For instance, in this very middle-class population, best quick insight into that, 74% had been to college. In that population, 28% of the women and 16% of the men acknowledged a history of contact childhood sexual abuse. That, believe me, was a surprise. I mean, I had difficulty believing it initially. In that population, anyone with an ACE score, we created a scoring system, a so-called ACE score. It was simply the sum of the number of categories of adverse childhood experience, not incidents or events, but categories. Anyone with an ACE score of 4 or more was 13 times more likely to attempt suicide in life, some point later in life, than someone with an ACE score of 0. If you went to an ACE score of 6 or more, it was a 46-fold increase in likelihood of attempted suicide. That is to say, a 4,600% increase.
Were you surprised especially by the impact on physical health? I mean, one might suspect that...
Yes, absolutely. And slowly we came to see that there were two broad mechanisms going on here. One was fairly easy to understand through various coping devices. You know, you smoke to feel better. Drink to feel, you know, sit down, have a drink, relax. So these various coping devices, overeating, heavy smoking, drinking, promiscuity, alcoholism, use of street drugs, etc., you know, those have major downside risks out in the future. So that was certainly one way of getting to chronic biomedical diseases. You know, that's fairly easy to understand. The more subtle pathway, And this is really just sort of in a beginning understanding now. The more subtle pathway is that caused by chronic unrelieved stress. It's now clear that high levels of circulating cortisone over prolonged periods of time are exceedingly damaging and have very complex mechanisms of disarray that are set into function, particularly if they are set in place early in life.
And what has been the reaction to the findings of the ACE study from a public health perspective?
Very interesting. We have, I believe, over 70 articles out in the world's medical literature. And the intellectual interest in it has been profound. The engagement into practice has been minimal to zero.
When you hear the results, one might think, what you found would cause nothing short of a revolution.
Yes.
Why has nothing changed based on the findings?
Start with a simple observation. In presenting the ACE study to medical audiences, let's say you have 200-300 doctors in the audience, and remembering that the speaker is the only one who can see the faces of everyone in the audience, what's striking is that by about 8 or so minutes into the presentation, the level of anguish on people's faces exceeds anything that I would be willing to attribute to empathic responses. I believe that personal ghosts are being awakened, and indeed supporting that, I've had many physicians come up, you know, to talk with me afterwards. Number two, if you believe the data, and it's hard not to, then you really have to recognize that this calls for a basic change in primary care medical practice, to move from our current symptom-reactive approach to the more comprehensive style of practice that was originally conceived for primary care but never really attained. no one standing in line, either to have ghosts awakened from their own past or to have that. And that kind of defense is easily supported with all sorts of plausible sounding explanations, like, well, you know, there's no time in medical practice, insurance doesn't cover it. Patients will be furious if you were to ask them questions like that. And besides, nobody would tell you the truth anyway. So that's part of it. The third thing is that from an administrative standpoint, the sums of money that are potentially involved are so huge that most people would be severely uncomfortable taking on a project that size.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was behavioral health reporter and our executive producer, Mike and Scott. She interviewed Dr. Vincent Folletti about this ACE study, A-C-E, Adverse Childhood Experience, and the astounding and profound results they found that, and apparently what's striking is the lack of response to these results. We're going to hear lots more about it from our guests here in the studio. After our short break, we're going to hear from Dr. Stephen Berkowitz. He's an associate professor of clinical psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. He's director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Dr. Sandra Bloom is a psychiatrist, nationally recognized expert on trauma. She's co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at the School for Public Health at Drexel University. And we'd like to hear from you after our break. Our number is 888-477-9499. Were you subjected to adverse childhood experience when you were younger, or are you concerned that your children are being exposed? And maybe you're a physician. We would very much like to hear from you about your response to this information. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
WHYY-FM has expanded our reach into New Jersey and welcomes former NJN listeners. You'll find many of your favorite shows are still available. Plus, you'll find programs exclusive to WHYY. For a complete hour-by-hour lineup, visit WHYY.org and let us know what you think. Email talkback at WHYY.org or like us on Facebook. WHYY-FM, member-supported public media for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Excuse me. We're talking about adverse childhood experience, or what I would call sustained stressors in childhood, things like recurrent physical or emotional abuse, substance abuse in the household, even living with someone who's chronically ill, like with depression, and things that so many of us live with, our children live with, just living with one or no parents. These are almost everyday events. So that's what we're talking about. My guests are Sandra Bloom and Stephen Berkowitz, psychiatrists both. Sandy is a nationally recognized expert on trauma. She's co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel. Sandy, welcome back to the show.
Nice to see you, Dan.
Steve Berkowitz is an associate professor at University of Pennsylvania. He is director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Steve, hi. Welcome back.
Hi, Dan.
So let's get right into this. You know, Steve, traditionally when we think about trauma in childhood, we think about a single incident. But your work, from our discussions and like the ACE study, is about sustained stressors, things like substance abuse in the family. What's the difference?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One, I'm not sure that there's ever a single incident trauma. Everybody has prior stressful experiences that can be reoccur in the sense of a single event that's major, like a motor vehicle accident or being exposed to a violent event. But the sustained experiences are similar in a way to what we talk about people when they have PTSD, which is the dysregulation of your neurobiologic systems and your stress systems. And so it's deregulated and sustained. And so these combinations, the accrual of events over time, are equally as dangerous as a huge event that causes an injury to the brain by experience.
Because I would think, Sandy, that with a relatively singular experience, I mean, Steve referred to what happens to the brain, that with a relatively singular experience, we'd come back to baseline pretty quickly, relatively quickly.
Compared to these kinds of experiences, which happen over and over again. Yeah, I think that's what's so really important about the ACEs study, is that Steve is a child psychiatrist. I am an adult psychiatrist, and we had a program for years treating adults who had these kinds of problems in their backgrounds. And so what we're really seeing in this study is the evolution over time of what happens to people who are exposed to things over and over and over, and what it does to their brain and their body.
It seems, if I understood it from this study, Sandy, that even it doesn't matter which stressors these kids were exposed to. It was simply the number?
It looks that way. It seems to represent a trauma score. That's how people are thinking about it now, that it's the no matter what causes it in some ways, the amount of arousal that your body experiences, the release of all those powerful chemicals, ends up being toxic when you're exposed to too much of it. We're obviously not designed for constant stress, particularly from people we're attached to.
So, Steve, it almost doesn't matter what we see or what the child sees or what story the child tells themselves about the experience. What matters is how the body reacts to the experiences.
Well, that's a very complicated question. I think it does matter if the child has really good functioning coping mechanisms to deal with the experience. I think what Sandy's pointing to is that, and to much to our surprise, it really is just the chronicity, the accumulation. And we know that bad things, unfortunately, tend to co-vary together. And so once one bad thing happens, and that's one of the things the ACEs study did show, is that it was rare for a person to only have one of those. That typically once you had one, you had more. So it's extremely rare. And so it does really change our physiology, and even at the genetic level.
I want to figure out what we are really looking at here. So the Stanford study we mentioned at the beginning of the show investigated this relationship between stressors and behavioral problems. The researchers found that many of these kids who were struggling with PTSD had been misdiagnosed with ADHD, I'm sure depression, and even probably bipolar disorder. So I wonder if people who are being treated for depression really are suffering with, I don't even know if PTSD is the right word here, Is it? Sandy, you're...
No, and there's a real push in the field to get a different diagnostic category into the DSM, you know, the Bible for diagnosing right. people, because we really don't have a diagnosis that represents the complexity of the problems that the adults end up with as a result of exposure to childhood adversity. And so we think really this study is looking more at what's underneath the water, that what we do now is there's lots of tips of icicles above the water, and what we're seeing is what the iceberg below the water.
So what do we need to learn about, even in with mental health professionals, about diagnosing that we don't know, Steve?
Well, I think that in general, a lot of the studies prior, I would say, to the last 5 years, really just looked at in a snapshot, what are you presenting with? What are your symptoms? And then they made a diagnosis. We don't really have a way of dealing with the causes and effects very well. So, for instance, there have been a number of studies that have looked at depressed women, for example, and shown that antidepressants don't work as well in women with histories of child abuse and sexual abuse as they do in women without those histories. And so it means that there needs to be a much more sophisticated intervention when you evaluate these adults, when you evaluate the children.
Or I'm afraid what happens to most of these where antidepressants don't work is we try new antidepressants or more or combinations. Sandy, you're nodding your head. I'm afraid you're going to throw something off kilter. what's going on over there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for many, many people, we're really missing the boat in terms of what they really need for treatment, and that what has happened through many forces on the healthcare and the mental healthcare system is that there is a huge emphasis on using medications and not doing other forms of treatment. But people with complex problems, a medication alone isn't probably not going to really help that much, can make things worse, can make people feel hopeless about something that really is treatable if they get the right treatment.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Susan on the line. Excuse me.
Susan. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know what the chance of recovery is, or if there's any information for childhood trauma when, like myself, I'm in therapy, I've been in therapy, but family members either aren't in therapy or don't deal with it together, and so we're all sort of off in our own worlds.
Do you mind?
To be perfectly honest.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Do you mind telling us a bit about what happened? You can be vague here.
I'm really glad you made the distinction between a singular event and lifelong issues, but the short version is that my father was extremely dysfunctional, and there was a lot of infidelity on his part, as well as he was severely egomaniacal. He had issues, and my mother stayed with him. So my brothers and I were, we were exposed to that, exposed to his behaviors, and although I was never sexually abused, there was a sense of abuse, you know. And other things happened later on in our lives that, you know, reflected that behavior, those behaviors in the family, but none of us came together to deal with what happened.
Okay, so
I'm just curious about that individual versus the group ability all right, to go into recovery.
We're going to address that, and there's other issues you bring up also. I'm going to ask you to take your answer off the air because we don't have a great connection. So let's first go to Susan's issue, and that is, and I'll turn to you, Sandy, about kind of collaborative care when it comes to healing from this.
Yeah, she asked the question whether recovery is possible.
Yeah.
And yes, it certainly is, if recovery means getting on a road to health and having the life that you want. It's always better the more the family is engaged, the more everybody is doing their work together, the better, because that's where Steve's work comes in from the very beginning with young children. But if not, if the family won't cooperate at first, sometimes you have to get on your own road to recovery and then still be engaged with the family to the extent that you safely right. can. And the family may move over time as they see that you've made a change. But change is critically important. Without changing what you do, nobody else will change either.
Steve, technically, her stress score would be a 1.
Or 2. Possibly. We didn't get it.
Right.
Great details, but what we did hear about was, again, the chronic stress.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to think about, that it's the chronic stress. It's not simply the nature or the type of event. It's that it was ongoing. It was throughout the house. It affected everybody, and it causes a lot of changes in how people perceive, think, and interact in the world.
I got a feeling from reading this research to prepare for this show that it almost changes the DNA. It like affects the architecture of one's being.
So what we do know now from both animal studies and now some human studies is that you're absolutely right, that there are mechanisms by which stress changes our ability to transcribe DNA effectively. And it has an effect throughout the body, throughout the, not just the brain, but the body as well. And there's even a recent study that came out of the study of the orphanages in Hungary that showed that the part of the chromosome that's responsible for sort of zipping up the DNA is shortened when there is too much adversity, which enhances and increases illness, health problems, and actually seems to increase rates of aging.
Hmm. We're talking about sustained childhood stressors and its impact on children, but things that don't show up often until later in life. We're talking with two psychiatrists, Stephen Berkowitz, Sandy Bloom, who are well-known experts in the field. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Now, we're not talking about single incident traumas here. We're talking about sustained stressors, things like emotional or physical neglect, one or no parents, violence in the home, sustained stressors like what we've been hearing about. So we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. Sandy, we heard from Dr. Folletti that they correlate these sustained stressors, correlate highly with things like broken long bones and diabetes. And when doing the research, even things like cardiac disease. How does that happen?
Well, we're not entirely sure yet, but we think it happens through the effect of chronic stress, that there is this whole very complex stress response, that there's a release of powerful chemicals, and that in a single incident, when as an acute response to stress, no problem, we go back to baseline, we're okay. But when it's happening over and over and over again, and if you think about the questions that they didn't put on the ACEs study that so many Philadelphia kids are exposed to. So the stress of having gunshots go off all the time, the stress of having to learn how to duck and cover in your house, of having people that you know shot or killed or stabbed, then, we can be talking about whole communities, whole neighborhoods that are experiencing chronic, unrelenting stress.
And I also want to add on to that, we've done shows on this, the stress of poverty itself and hunger and
exactly.
food insecurity, and they're all tremendous stressors. Yeah, what struck me about this original study is 75% of the people were college graduates. I mean, we weren't talking about. So add to it, you know,
exactly.
the kind of population you're talking about. It's kind of heartbreaking. Steve, when Mikan was speaking in the interview to Dr. Folletti, and he was talking about nothing happening in medical practice, despite all we're learning, you had a visible reaction. I don't want to read your mind, but you had a reaction when he was talking about ghosts being awakened in doctors.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think anytime you talk about adverse experience and traumatic impact, we've all had them, and we don't like to think about them. And one of the biggest problems is, despite bringing this kind of information to policymakers and so on and so forth, people don't want to hear about it. It's too painful. And so they avoid the topic. And it takes an enormous amount of political will to change a system. Most diseases, at least half of our diseases, medical and otherwise, are preventable. They're behavioral in origin, and they highly correlate to early childhood adverse experience. It's clear. There, I don't think anybody questions it. We understand a lot of the neurobiology and physical biology of this now. And yet, it's a sea change in how we think about medical practice. And it would require a wholesale reevaluation of what we do. It's not simply that physicians avoid it. It's so much more complicated than the avoidance. It's a whole way of rethinking. It's about preventing illness and starting from the get-go. And we know how to do that. We actually have programs that work, and yet we don't seem to fund them, we don't seem to support them. And we have a long way to go to convince those policymakers and insurance companies that is the best way to practice medicine.
Is that what has to be done?
It's a beginning. Yeah, I mean, what Steve's describing, really, and Vince Folletti did, is the need for a social revolution. To really change what we think about how to take care of children and what children really need to grow up to be healthy mentally, socially, and physically.
We've got to take a short break, but I am reminded of many years ago, we did a show with Deborah Prothro-Stith.
Sure.
And she was at the time associate dean of medical school, I think, at Harvard, and she did a lot of this work. And she said, I'll never forget, she said, my children, she said, will get my time, money, and resources. It's the nature of having children. She said, I can decide whether they'll get it now or whether they'll get it later in life, because if I don't do it for them now, they're going to require it later in life. And so too with all of our children. And it seems like we're making the decision now not to give it to them early in life as a culture. And, you know, at the time, I don't know if it's still the case, that, you know, the most rapidly growing industry is prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Now, I don't know if that's still the case, but, you know, that's what we're doing. And in today's world, I think that's even more so what's happening. Well, like I said, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk more about what we can do, but I want to also have all of us listen to a very poignant and powerful piece Mike and Scott recorded about an experience she had when she went back to her native Germany very, very recently. Well, we're talking about sustained childhood stressors today on Voices. We're with Sandy Bloom, psychiatrist and expert on trauma, co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at the School of Public Health at Drexel. Steve Berkowitz is an associate professor of psychiatry at U of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view through September 4th, Urbanism, Reimagining the Lived Environment, an exhibition of emerging artists from Philadelphia whose works express the experience of urban space in original and unexpected ways. Artists featured in the exhibition, Arden Bendler Browning, the Dufala Brothers, Ben Peterson, and Amy Walsh. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org.
He is a prominent anchor at a national cable network, but he was holding on to two secrets until recently.
I cannot write a book about my life and not talk about what I have been for the past 44 years. And a big part of that is being gay. And part of it was also having a childhood where I was molested.
CNN's Don Lemon is with us on his new memoir, Transparent. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about sustained childhood stressors and their impact on adults later in life. We're with psychiatrists Sandy Bloom and Steve Berkowitz, both nationally known experts on this topic. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Carol on the line. Carol?
Yes. My question is, does this accumulated childhood trauma translate into autoimmune diseases?
We're getting nods from both of my guests, but nobody's forthcoming with. Anybody want to say anything?
Sure. There's been clearly a correlation between child adverse experiences and trauma and autoimmune diseases. Stress and chronic stress does a lot of different things to the body. Increases inflammation, for instance, and that's one of the mechanisms that we think cardiovascular disease is involved. So, and we also know that autoimmune diseases are primarily a disease of inappropriate inflammation. So there's a correlation that has been shown in that area.
Mm. So there you are. I guess it answers your question. Wish there was a different answer. I want to follow up with something related. We've got a caller who's calling in about her husband's depression and the fact that the daughter lives with chronic stress. But, you know, I've treated families where a parent has had depression, and how it's dealt with makes all the difference in the world. I treated a family where a mother had depression, and in a family session, you know, we explained to the daughter what depression is, what she could and couldn't do, what mom was doing to care for her depression, and that was not a childhood stressor, so depression alone is not a stressor. Like I said earlier, I do want to listen to that piece Mike and recorded earlier. Let's hear a brief essay she recorded called Walking to School with a Murderer.
Ragnar, with a name like a Nordic warrior and an unreasonable height for his 8 years, Ragnar should have been feared among his classmates in second grade. But he was chubby, somehow soft all over, and cried easily. I thought of him this summer when I stayed at my parents' house, my childhood home. Walking to the bakery with my children early one morning, I found myself retracing my old walk to elementary school. I passed by Ragnar's old block, a group of low-income high-rises. I'd pick him up here on my way to school, as if I, scrawny and unreasonably small for my age, could protect him from the bullies in our school and class. Making Ragnar cry was a game, an easy one at that. I felt sorry for him, even though I wasn't entirely sure that I liked him either. He never said much, and chatty as I was, I couldn't draw him into conversations. I feared his mother, a tall, overpowering woman who even at my young age I recognized as an alcoholic. Her face was red, swollen with anger and last night's excesses. There was no father. When I left elementary school to move into another school, I left Ragnar and his tormentors behind. A little over a decade later, I was asked to cover a murder trial by my first radio station. The defendant, Ragnar, my old classmate and protection project. I went through the trial even though I clearly should have excused myself. Ragnar had the same baby face, the same stunned expression that showed no real emotion. He had viciously killed two men. Looking for a place to stay, they had taken him in, but wanted sex in exchange. He stabbed them to death. I'm not one to make excuses for violent behavior, but I wonder what happened to Ragnar. As a 7-year-old, I sensed the suffering he experienced, but knew nothing of child abuse, trauma, and its effects. Today, I sense the suffering of so many children around me. I can see their hurt. I now know about trauma and its effects, but I sit silently. At least Ragnar, I walk to school.
So, Stephen, Sandy, you know, I read that essay over the weekend, and it took my breath away. I heard it recorded twice, and it still takes my breath away. It's so very real, and especially at the end, we all see these kids, and what do we do? And we, you know, we should start off with a disclaimer. Not everybody sustained the childhood stressors is going to turn into a murderer. Most of them turn in on themselves. But what do we do when we look at these kids who you can see in their eyes they're suffering? You know, besides a sea change in health care, it's a little child that we see. What can we do, anybody?
Well, I think many of us are asking that question every day in our work, and you know, it is a societal issue, even though it's one child, and you think about one child at a time, because there are all these systems who don't recognize what's going on and don't intervene. There are, as Sandy said, recovery's possible. Interventions and treatments do work, either at the individual, sometimes at the family level, depending on how long this has gone on for and how impaired the caregivers and parents are. But we need to be able to recognize it. We need to be able to support the work. And frankly, we need to prevent all these things from happening. Prevention is probably our best role and our most effective role. And there are ways of doing this that require a large-scale change in our way of thinking, our way of doing things. Individual children, we work with them all the time, and they do get better, and their families get better. But they have to be identified and acknowledged. And too many of them are just ignored or we don't even think about it, particularly in poverty and urban settings.
I am going to go out on a bit of a limb here with two experts on trauma and treatment and say this, that a lot of this suffering is about children suffering and being ignored at the same time. So here's the limb I'm going to go out on, that as a layman, we can help a child feel less ignored. You know, I talk at almost all of my lectures about four words that can change the world. And those four words are, tell me your story. Just look at a child and say, in so many words, you know, tell me your story, to see a human in there behind those eyes. It won't change that child's life, maybe, but maybe it will.
Maybe it will.
Maybe it will.
I think that very question that you asked about what can we do is, it really drove me out of clinical practice and into public health, because it was really kind of treating people, the story about the babies coming down the river, and we run in and grab out a baby and wonder, then finally somebody has to ask, who's throwing the babies in upstream? And I did individual work for a long time and really then saw as a result a lot of this study that it's a huge public health problem. And in public health, there are three ways to think about it. There's primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. So tertiary prevention is when you treat people who already have the problem. Secondary is when you focus on kids at risk. Primary is what goes for everybody. So this issue is really takes us from how we vote and how we decide to what we decide to do with our money, all the way to the individual case that you just talked about saying to a troubled child, tell me your story.
Well, let me. Of course I agree with you. I want to say this for the people who are out there, the Mikens of the world, watching these children. And I just want to say, yeah, vote, all that. Nag your congresspeople to wake up to this, all of that. But I want to say that if you look a child in the eye and engage in that child even for a moment, then your life is going to be changed. And then you're more likely to show up at a Boys and Girls Club and want to be helpful there. And then you're more likely to travel to Washington and so on and so forth. But it starts with looking a child in the eye and seeing a human there.
I think there's no question about that, Dan, that knowing people, getting to know the child, and the connectedness that we all experience as human beings is a powerful healing force. I think that, these are sustained stressors and traumas. The relationships that work and heal also have to be sustained. Schools, girls and boys clubs, other areas where children are, pediatric offices, etc. Those sustained caring relationships, telling me your story, what can I do for you, those are the ones that really can have a positive effect on children's lives.
And it's also talking to the little child inside every grown-up. So with people that you work with, people that you are your neighbors, people who are behaving in a way that you don't understand, it's really useful instead of saying to them or inside of yourself, what is wrong with you, to be saying, what happened to you? Tell me your story. And it's a totally different way of really approaching each other, whether it's a little kid or a grown-up that's dealing with a little kid or just a grown-up.
So is that what you mean when you talk a lot about, you talk about trauma-informed therapy, trauma-informed doctor's offices, trauma-informed workplaces?
Exactly.
Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's about, one of the ideas in public health is universal precautions. So that's why we wash our hands whenever we go to eat, right? And universal precautions in this sense is everybody understanding that there is a trauma survivor next to you, in all likelihood. From what we know now, in this city in Philadelphia, in all likelihood, yes, there's somebody next to you that is a trauma survivor. Now, what are you going to do? Are you going to make that situation worse for that other person, or are you going to try to make it better?
The research on sexual abuse I did years ago, At the time, it was estimated 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 6 boys. So that alone, and here we're talking about sustained stressors. I would imagine that's even more commonplace, But even if it's not, I think that question, what happened to you? What was it like back then? What is it like now? I mean, these are human questions.
Yes, and crucial, and I also think it's important as we're talking about really what is a very upsetting and sad reality, is also to recognize that there are a lot of kids who go through these experiences and are resilient and grow and are the ones who actually make changes in some of the things that we're talking about. And so it's not an either or.
Yeah, there's also a lot of work being done around the phenomenon of post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they're talking about sustained stressors, probably not, but post-traumatic growth occurs, it's estimated, in 60% of the people who've endured trauma. They're probably talking about singular trauma like a cancer diagnosis or a catastrophic car accident that leaves a radio host screwed
right
up here.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody comes to a choice point after anything bad has happened. Am I going to be part of the problem or am I going to be part of the solution?
We've got about a minute left, and I know you've got strong feelings about the arts, Sandy, as
I
part
do.
Of the healing. Look at that smile. So go on.
I think what we found, one of the important things we found about people that experience trauma is that you can't always put it into words, and you can't always immediately tell your story verbally, but that there are lots of ways to tell your story. So some people draw, some people act, some people sing, some people dance. And all of that is necessary when in a population. So the last thing we should be defunding is arts programs in schools, in the community, because that those are off. They may be our naturally evolved way of having healing that is intrinsic in our families and in our culture.
To wit, we are talking from Philadelphia, probably the city most famous in the world for its mural arts program,
right.
And that's all about healing and larger communities.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you, Dan.
And mostly thank you for the work you do. And, boy, I wish you every success in anything I can do, we can do to help make this sea change happen. My guests have been Steve Berkowitz, Sandy Bloom, both psychiatrists, researchers par excellence, and I'm proud to say dear friends of mine. Steve is director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Sandy is co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at the School of Public Health at Drexel University. Earlier in the show, we heard from Vince Folletti. He's an internist with Kaiser Permanente. He was the co-lead author of the aforementioned ACE study. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be doing a show on collaborative divorce, what some might think is an oxymoron, but it really is a whole new way of looking at divorce. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, we are at voices@whyy.org. If you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Our interns are Emily Haas and Evan Plith. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.